For June 21st, 2010, it's the Overthinking It Podcast, episode 103, The Infallible Wikipedia. Welcome to the Overthinking It Podcast, where we subject the popular culture to a level of scrutiny it probably doesn't deserve. From Los Angeles, California, you may have heard of it. It's in Los Angeles, California. I'm your host, Matthew Rather, here with the panel to overthink many, many things because we're doing listener feedback tonight. So we have your calls and we have your emails queued up and ready to play, and we will answer your questions and overthink your overthinking, and it will be just like a giant circle think. Wow.
Ew. Yeah,
I know. Maybe it won't be. You know what? Actually, let's do it so that it's not like that at all, and I'll never, ever even think that thought again. But we have a panel tonight. So, panel, in honor of Toy Story 3 coming out, which, of course, none of us saw, because it was not the A-Team, let's do a round on favorite childhood toy. Maybe in these early childhood experiences, we can see the roots of overthinkers coming to fruition, or that would later come to fruition, I mean to say. On cell phone, from a bench in a park, it's Peter Fenzel.
Hey, are you? And we don't have to go in alphabetical order tonight? This is okay.
Hey, shut up, Fenzel.
Well, no, I can go. I can totally go, man. You don't have alphabetical.
My mistake. First game, alphabetical. Rather. Oh, I just dangled it out in front of you so that I could snatch it away. That's the kind of jerk I am. Natalie Baseman, coming from first in the alphabet.
Thank you. Sorry, Pete. Maybe next time. All right. Favorite toy. One of my favorite toys growing up was actually a toy that my mother owned, and it was a Ginny doll, which was an old doll from, she would have had it in the 50s, mid-50s probably, or early 50s. And I thought it was really cool to be playing with a doll that was almost as old as my mother. Is that weird? It's kind of weird thinking about it now, but I had all the old furniture and it was kind of falling apart and it looked really weird, but it felt more genuine to be playing with something that felt handmade and wasn't just plastic like a Barbie doll. So my favorite toy was my Ginny doll.
What was its special ability? Did it like discriminate against minorities?
It actually did this. It did this great thing, which was modern technology, of that when you laid her down on her back, her eyes closed, and then when you sat her up, her eyes would open like a real girl.
I'm trying to think of something else, like, you know, okay, to tie into racism or sexism at the time. But I'm gonna stop pooping all over your childhood. So.
Yeah, well, she grew up not thinking she could do anything with her life, but is now in a box in my attic. So she was probably right.
Well, here's my question about that. Like, aren't girls? Don't you have baby dolls? Like, and girls can kind of play mother with, you know, with dolls that are that are younger than them? I mean, what is it like to have a doll that's considerably older than you? I mean, does the doll tell you what to do? Like, you like, hey, doll, it's time to have a tea party. No, we're not having a tea party. Do your homework.
Yeah, that was pretty much it. That was exactly it. No, I don't really get the whole baby doll for babies thing, which I probably goes against something I actually did do when I was a child. I remember playing with dolls, but never really a baby doll. I think it's kind of fun that way, maybe. Like you think, oh, I was a baby recently. Let me play with one like my mommy played with me. Except I can leave it on the stage somewhere and forget about it.
And child services won't come after you.
Right.
Memories. I remember those times. They were pretty rough.
All right, Pete. It's your turn now.
Oh, good. Oh, I can go now? Thank you. See, look how big of a man I am. I know I love going first, but when it's not the right thing to do, I don't do it. And speaking of people who do the right thing, my favorite toy was a very peripheral He-Man toy. And I actually had to search my soul a little bit, because I don't think this is the answer that I necessarily would always give, but in this moment, this is the one that jumped out at me. So for some reason, ancillary to He-Man, there was a dinosaur, right? For some sort of He-Man-related dinosaur. And this dinosaur was like about maybe a foot and a half tall, and it was one of my more like fancy toys. I didn't particularly care for the dinosaur, especially. Like, the dinosaur is fine. It got moldy, and my basically had to throw it away. The remarkable thing about the dinosaur, however, was a trap door in its stomach. And when the door opened and sort of a drawbridge dropped out, there was a little robot. And it was basically shaped like a hockey puck, and it had sort of plastic molded engravings on the side to make it look like it was some sort of robot. But it was shaped like a hockey puck, and it had two little arms that extended out from an axle that ran not through its center, but off-center. And they ran out maybe about a quarter of an inch away from the robot, and then went at a 90-degree angle, sort of two ski-like appendages would come out of it. And it would rotate in such a way that the little hockey puck could pull itself along the ground with its like little whipping arms if you wound it up. So what you were supposed to do is wind up the robot, put it inside the dinosaur's stomach, close the dinosaur's stomach, bring He-Man into an altercation with the dinosaur such that it appears He-Man has the upper hand in combat with the dinosaur, put He-Man directly in front of the dinosaur at about an 8-inch distance, lower the stomach of the dinosaur, and hope that the little robot jumps out and knocks over He-Man. It's the most overthought toy that I had, I think.
In the sense that it involves an absurd number of steps, of complicated steps.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, ones that were totally counterintuitive. Like, why, like, I don't really understand why He-Man is fighting a dinosaur in the first place, let alone a dinosaur that keeps inorganic material in its stomach for no reason. Right? And I'm sure that there was some sort of elaborate framing device. What I used to love to do is, long after I stopped playing with the He-Man dolls, I would wind up this little hockey puck guy, and I would drop him from a height of about 3 feet and watch his arms like thrash around as he attempted to right himself and speed off into the wall, which was definitely like a fun little existential challenge for a little plastic accoutrement.
That's another.
I love that toy.
That's another sort of tenet of overthinking I've noticed, is that putting things to uses that they're not originally intended for is kind of a good use, a good metaphor for the use we put, entertainment artifacts to.
Right. I say the same thing I always say about this stuff, which is that I don't want to apologize for the things that I love. So sure, like you might say it's purposeless, but that's what I chose to do. So let's investigate why. That's the question.
Also, long, involved, and complicated also describes a lot of articles that we write. So much like the toy, so are our articles.
So too is our podcast. Mark Lee, favorite toy?
I'm going to go a little bit out of the box here. Not something that can be easily anthropomorphized.
That's funny, because toys come in boxes.
It's true. Thank you for pointing that out, Matt. What, are you going to come in there with another pun? No? Okay, cool. I'm going to go on. My answer is Legos. I know that's not quite in the same vein as Transformers or He-Man's or whatever, or He-Man's or He-Men or dolls or things like that, which, or G.I. Joe's can be anthropomorphized and sort of take on characters and that sort of thing. I was all about Legos and building, ships and planes. And my major accomplishment was an X-Wing. This is back before they made the fancy Star Wars branded sets, the kits where it gave you all the parts you needed and instructions and things. Nope, I made... I cobbled together an X-Wing out of whatever bricks I could find, so they come out blue and yellow and red and white, and with, you know, a little smiley face dude inside of there instead of Luke Skywalker or whatever the special Rebel Alliance Lego guy that they had in there. So much like I cobbled disparate elements together in my writing for overthinking it, so did I put together Legos and create things. There you have it. And my answer was so amazing that it just blew everyone away.
It struck everyone dumb. I'm kind of angry now because you stole mine. Mine was blocks. I had wooden blocks, and my reasoning was going to be much like yours. But my wooden blocks were, in fact, my favorite toy, and I would build fortresses out of wooden blocks in the middle of my bedroom floor. And I think that fortresses, building any sort of structure, I think when you're a child, is a metaphor for the self. You know, there are things that you have to build. There's sort of functions that you have to build into a fortress. You know, like your body has skin, you know, the fortress needs walls and it needs doors and, you know, things like this, just like you need sort of portals with through which to interact with the world. And, you know, and the uses to which you put your fortress is sort of akin to the uses to which you put yourself. Like, people come up to the fortress and either they can come in and you can be friends, or else they can't come in, and things like this. So I think blocks are really like a Rorschach test. Any sort of non-structured toy like that is really sort of a Rorschach test for children. But I won't give that as my answer, because you already took that non-structured play. You kind of played that card, if you will, out of the box. So my answer is going to be Sky Commanders. Sky Commanders was a show, an animated Saturday morning show where it was people who, like, lived in a mountainous cliff-like region in the future, and they wore backpacks that had the unique ability to be able to shoot out of a cannon on top of a backpack, shoot a zip line to the other side of the canyon, and another one behind you, and then your backpack would then be like your harness on the zip line, so that you could zip from mountain peak to mountain peak. And there were more complicated ones that shot conveyor belts from place to place, and they had, you know, fortresses in the mountains. And I had a number of these toys. I didn't buy a lot of Transformers. I didn't buy a lot of He-Man toys. But I had a lot of Sky Commanders, and they would they had, you know, fortresses that, like, clamped to a bookshelf or something. And my room was crisscrossed with strings, and I would hang these little Sky Commander toys on strings. Does anyone remember that? Does anyone watch that cartoon? Or was it just
no? Me? I never heard of Sky Commanders until now.
Okay,
but I love zip lines.
I enjoyed the Silverhawks a lot.
I love me a good zip line, though. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, it was well, and it was like this was it was install your own zip line wherever you are. That's how awesome the Sky Commanders were. Like, you know, you work in the thriving metropolis of New York City. So, you know, imagine if in order to get to the next building, you didn't have to take the elevator down to the first floor, walk across the street, navigating, you know, traffic signals and pedestrians and automobiles and bicycles and things like this, and then go in, deal with the security measures at the door, and then take the elevator up. Imagine you could just, you know, stand outside on a balcony or at a window, shoot your zip line across the avenue to the other building, and then your magic backpack would carry you across. Can you imagine how awesome a world would be where we all could carry our own zip lines with us?
Oh, not only can I imagine it, I have imagined it before many times.
That's true. That's a very kind of citified fantasy. Well, okay, that is our panel for tonight. We are going to do listener feedback. We have your calls.
Because we didn't watch Toy Story like the rest of America.
Yeah, right. Like, yeah, $100 million plus for Toy Story this weekend, right?
Damn.
Something like that. Yeah, I don't know. Pixar is going to have to, what goes up must come down, but, you know, shows no sign of coming down yet. All right. Let's start off the voicemail run with a question from an old friend about Star Trek.
Hey, Overthinkers. This is Ben, a.k.a. Crindog, calling from 41 degrees, 47 minutes north latitude and 87 degrees, 35 minutes west longitude, also known as the South Side of Chicago, Illinois. I just want to call, say hello, and give you a shout-out, tell you how much I've been enjoying the podcast, and also congratulate you on approaching 100 podcasts. It's an awesome milestone. Anyway, I just want to say that, and I especially I feel compelled to call in because every time Star Trek is mentioned on the podcast, I want to leap out of my chair and jump into the conversation. So in that vein, I wanted to quickly mention that I enjoyed there was a discussion several episodes ago about starship names, and in particular, someone mentioned the USS Defiant on Star Trek Deep Space Nine and how it was kind of an ironic name given that it's a military vessel within a military-type structure. And I was thinking that, or perhaps overthinking, that maybe Defiant was actually intentionally chosen because Captain Sisko on that show, like Captain Kirk before him, is a lead character who's particularly prone to disobeying orders, kind of disobeying the Prime Directive and all that kind of good stuff to get the bad guys and resolve the plots of the show. So anyway, keep up the good work. Hope you guys are all doing well, and hopefully talk to you soon. Take care. Bye.
That's
Before we get into the Star Trek issue that Crindog brought up there, I do want to thank Crindog and his coterie, who were largely responsible for introducing me to Terminator, and I have them to thank for becoming such a Terminator fanboy that I am. So consequently, everybody who listens to the podcast and reads the site who enjoys me rambling about Terminator has folks like Crindog to thank. Just want to put that out there.
I also would like to thank myself for giving him the name Crindog, because I thought that was a really great move. And it's really sort of well over the edge. He's also one of my favorite people, and I'm really glad that he still listens to the show. That's awesome.
Yeah. Nice when our buddies call it. All right, Defiant.
Sure. So here's one thing. So I don't know if any of you guys read The Stone, which is the philosophy column in the New York Times. But
I don't subscribe to drug culture. I disapprove such things.
Fair enough. But they had an interesting piece this past week that I think this connects with, which was they're trying to explain, this might have been, why people in the Tea Party are so angry, right? And that's not really important. What is important was that the person was positing that contemporary ideas of individuality are dependent upon the sort of endorsement of the social structure, right? Which is that people get upset when you take away their freedoms, not because they want to be free and you're making them less free, but because they never really were free to the degree that they said they were free, and you're forcing them to acknowledge that reality. And so a fantasy of sort of living within a military superstructure like Captain Kirk, and Captain Kirk does like 99.99% things like totally by the books, you know, very much in accordance with the chain of command. Picard is a lot like that. Sisko is like that. And every once in a while, when it's really important, he disobeys orders. And I mean, yeah, maybe it's once an episode, but still not that often. So it's a fantasy character because he's supported by all these engineers and laborers and like people who put the ship together that make it possible for him to be there with this bajillion, you know, dollars. Like, money is even meaningless because he lives in this socialist utopia spaceship in this faraway distant galaxy, supported as the ambassador of his entire advanced civilization. And then he gets to be a rebel. Right, so he's not a rebel from the ground up. He can't be. He'd never be empowered that he does. He has to be the product of the organization. He has to be dependent upon this organization. And then the organization creates the idea of individuality as a cultural thing that is not really in existence on its own terms within the superstructure. So that was what sort of the part of the irony of the name Defiant. It's also a fitting name because it kind of captures that tension between individuality and the supportive group. I mean, did anybody... Does that ring a bell for anybody? Any thoughts about and that kind of thinking? I don't know how you guys feel about freedoms. You know, they're not free. I think they're about $1.99, which is a good deal.
It was a buck 05 around 2004, but the you know inflation rate, I guess, has brought it up to $1.99.
Yeah, no, it costs a hefty effing fee.
Yeah, fair enough.
Deep Space Nine follower. My Star Trek really stops after Next Generation. I've been thinking of obtaining Deep Space Nine and watching it all the way through because I feel like my credibility as a Trekkie is compromised by the fact that I don't know a great deal about the excellent enunciation of Avery Brooks in Deep Space Nine, or the ruggedly handsome good looks of Scott Bakula in Star Trek Enterprise.
All you need to know, Matt. All you need to know about Deep Space Nine, casino. There's a casino, and lots of. Oh God, it's I'm totally blanking. Hollow Sweets, there's a lot of the Ferengi. It's really heavy on the Ferengi.
A lot of makeup, a lot of character makeup in Deep Space Nine.
That's what I remember. Now, there's actually a furniture store in Central Square in Cambridge that when it closes, there's just a TV on at the front of the store that you can see as you walk by. Every single time I walked by there, it's always playing Deep Space Nine.
No, it's always playing Voyager. Every time I walk by that place, it's always playing Voyager.
Really?
I think there's a disruption in the space-time continuum, you guys, which is causing alternate parallel universes to appear depending when Natalie or when Pete walks by.
Oh, my God.
Whoa. No, I think, I hate to say this, Pete, but I think you're overthinking it. Or also to Crindog, I think you guys are overthinking it. The Defiant is not so much in reference to the captain who is piloting the ship as it is its mission and it being defined against its enemy. Page says that the Defiant is a prototype vessel for the Defiant class warship originally developed to counter the Borg threat. So it's not the Defiant against their own command, against their enemy, which is the Borg.
Well, I think you're underthinking that, Mark. I think that when you have a rebel commander piloting a ship named the Defiant, I don't think you need to consider the instrumentality that's described in Wikipedia at the end of the question.
Wait, he's a rebel commander. I mean, it was commanded by Captain Sisko, right? And then
did he go rogue?
He went rogue a lot. You know, I mean, he disputes the Federation's peace with the Dominion. Whole situation with Deep Space Nine where he's on the frontier and he doesn't get the support that he needs to do what he thinks is right in his environment. And Deep Space Nine is kind of like another kind of Western style Star Trek show, except instead of being them out on the frontier and like the dust towns, like the cowboys rumbling into town, it's like the old West mayor trying to exact justice in a place where people are coming and going. That's the sort of saloon environment and stuff. So he pretty frequently gets told to do things he doesn't want to do. I mean, I would say the central theme of Deep Space Nine is the administration of justice and the sort of enforcement of what passes for the law. And in that sense, there's a lot of issues with and restriction. And I think that Defiant is a sort of telling name of the ship. I mean, I guess you can even divide the show into the part before the authority, and Sisko is trying to sort of assert an authority, and Odo is trying to assert an authority. And then you have a question of, does authority exist, you know, a priori, or is it something that has to be asserted in order to exist? Like, is there a rightful legal structure, not even legal, but just an authoritative structure that ought to exist in Deep Space Nine, or is it only the product of sort of positivism and the will of Sisko to enforce it, which is how he's always contrasted with the Cardassians and how he chooses to apply this particular impetus. And then it switches over to the Dominion, where you have a very, very strongly hostile enforcement of will, which is coming from this overwhelming force, and Sisko has been told on many occasions just not to fight them, and he fights them, and that gets him in trouble. And that sort of, the Defiant goes on stealth missions, and has to sort of operate under the radar, and so he is defying orders, which is, generally is to try to keep him out of trouble, but at the same time, he's also creating order. He's creating order in his defiance of orders. It's sort of like a squatter in a house trying to exert a sort of ownership right over something. Like, ownership isn't something that exists in a sacrosanct place. It's the product of assertions and sort of legal structure that supports assertions. And you have to say that you own something in order to own it. You have to say that something is the law in order for it to be the law.
Well,
that's kind of one of the
Yeah, but it's two. I mean, it's two things, isn't it? I mean, ownership is a product of assertion, but it's also a product of that assertion being ratified by the community, by the larger community.
Well, yeah, definitely. I mean, you have to have some sort of framework. I mean, that's what the court system is. But in the heart of the court system is the judges. And these are people who are vested with the authority to do these things. Of course, we're talking about, we live in the United States, which has sort of a common law background. It's going to be different if you're under a Napoleonic Code, and there's going to be different ways of dealing with these things. But I think still, you know, judges administer and mediate these assertions, and it's a lot of people that are claiming things, and you have to pick which claim is sort of the one that you're going to go with.
So,
in
essence,
there's definitely human will behind it. It's not a machine.
Naming the starship Defiant it turns out to be kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, well, and I think he's sort of, you know, tempting fate. Right? I mean, I don't know what if you had a motorcycle and you named it Bad Mamma Jamma. Like, do you think you would use it to deliver newspapers? I mean, possibly, but it would be ironic. I don't know. You have to be doing something Mamma and Jamma-ing with this, right? I mean, isn't that sort of the impetus? Isn't that the imperative of the name? I don't know. Maybe I'm a little bit too romantic about naming things.
Let's actually talk. I was just thinking about naming things because, you know, let's throw out some names of starships in the Star Trek universe that we can think of, because it strikes me that there are commemorative names and there are aspirational names in Star Trek, right? So the Enterprise is an aspirational name, or the Defiant is an aspirational name. That is to say, we hope that in the face of our enemies, we can be defiant, or, you know, we are embarking on a great enterprise, which we hope will succeed. There are also the commemorative names, like the second Defiant was renamed Defiant, Wikipedia tells me. After the first Defiant was destroyed, Starfleet sent a replacement ship, the USS Sao Paulo, named after the city in Brazil, right? And it was renamed Defiant. Yeah. So that's like, right, the Sao Paulo or the Enterprise D's sister ship, which I believe is the USS Yamamoto, which is presumably named after Mr. Yamamoto.
Named after the battleship Yamamoto, which is a famous Japanese battleship, and also a famous Japanese science fiction show. The battleship Yamamoto. It's like someone raising the USS Oklahoma, or is it the Arizona, the one in Pearl Harbor. Like someone raising the sunken battleship, giving it a space engine, and flying it off in outer space. It's a famous anime for children from the 80s, I think.
Yamamoto was also an admiral in the Japanese Navy during World War II.
Right.
I think he led the attack on Pearl Harbor, actually.
Yeah.
Isn't he the guy who said the famous thing about attacking America, which was something like, I fear all we have done is awaken a sleeping giant and fill him with a terrible resolve, was, you know...
all he did was compliment America the whole time. That's the only thing the guy did in his life. And that's why he's awesome. That's what the history books say. Those winners, right? Well, I think he might have been the guy who said that.
Yeah, be the guy who said that, because he masterminded this attack, but it was kind of... was kind of uneasy about its implications. So, right. So, I mean, that when we name something, we're paying a debt, or we're incurring a debt in a sense, right? Like we're paying a debt to the past by commemorating something or by commemorating someone or some place that is notable. And that's the place names or the people names in starships. Or we're incurring a debt that we intend to pay back in the future by giving an aspirational quality that Defiant or Enterprise or Reliant, right? Or Valiant, you know, or something like that. All of these names, though, in a way, like Reliant is a worse. We talked about this, didn't we? Reliant is a bad starship name.
Yeah.
Even more so than Bull. 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 Bull.
Bull. Shit.
Is.
You got a ton of interference there, Matt.
Okay,
it really,
it's not coming in on my end, and I'm doing the recording. So unless I'm really unintelligible, it's not so much of a problem. Should we go on to the next voicemail and see if I can't?
Actually, can I bring up one more thing? Can I bring up one more thing on this?
Sure.
Okay. Are we rolling?
Yep.
So let me ask you this: how about the Pegasus? I think that's the ship that Picard takes. Is that the ship that Picard takes command of during the emergency that sort of elevates him to being a command officer and sort of launches his career as a starship captain? Because that's not commemorating something that's real, and is it aspirational? I guess Pegasus is aspirational in a metaphorical sense, but it's also historical. I mean, there are other, and I guess Excelsior it's historical in the sense that it's the motto of the state of New York, and that's the ship that Sulu takes command of in Star Trek VI. Although I think he might also... Does he have it in Star Trek V? I don't think... No, he doesn't. He might have it in Generations as well. But yeah, what about... I just kind of feel like we got to stand up for the Trekkies here and throw a couple more out there. What do you guys think? Do you think of anything about Pegasus, or does that fit into the rubric, or do we have to make a new classification?
Well, I think yes, it's metaphorical, but it fits into the aspirational classification, right? Because like we hope that this show has the awesome qualities of a Pegasus, like A, being a horse, and B, having wings.
It's important for everyone to have dreams, so definitely.
Yeah. So I sort of naming. So in a way, though, I think you've identified a special case, because in a way you're looking back and forward with that, right? Because Pegasus isn't an abstract quality. It's a historical mythological entity. I mean, there were American ships named Pegasus. So.
Well, the ship also exists in the past in Star Trek. Also, it's a flashback. Like, it happens in the before the narrative.
Yeah, it was Riker's ship, wasn't it?
Oh, it was Riker's? Oh, I'm confusing the Pegasus. Then that's just Riker's.
It wasn't his ship. I mean, he doesn't have a ship until after the timeline of the Next Generation TV series. But I think it was his first assignment. I think it was the first ship he was assigned to.
Oh, so what I'm confusing with the name of a different ship. Then there was definitely one that Picard was on at one point. I guess Pegasus was the one for Riker. Never mind then. The Trekkies can get mad at me now. I'm trying to be so nice to them and give them and throw them bones, but boy, I just like to go because he's a doctor, not a baseball. So,
the episode, I guess, was called The Pegasus. Directed by LeVar Burton. A little bit of Star Trek. Trivia there. I think they all kind of directed an episode. I mean, well, maybe not all of them, but I think a number of them directed episodes of the show, which in television is kind of less august than it sounds like. Directors in television are largely kind of deal with camera traffic and the major kind of storytelling authority falls to the writers. But Jonathan Frakes came out of that, and he's actually a pretty good director, I think.
He did Clockstoppers.
Sorry?
I said he did Clockstoppers, which is a movie based off of a DuckTales episode, sort of.
Wow, I love how we've gotten exactly one voicemail in. Let's let's push on.
Excel store. All right.
Let's push on with this from Noah Mittman.
Hey guys, it's Noah Mittman. You know, instead of replying to you guys over Twitter and et cetera, I think I'll take Rather's offer up and leave a voicemail. I have an issue with Priest, and I think maybe just the manga Christianity thing that you're talking about. I feel like it's not because Christianity is like foreign in Japan, and as far as I can tell, Christianity is overwhelming Japan and is like actually like threatening Shinto as a mainstream religion over there. I think it's just that it's new. And I think that it's not as like sacrosanct as it is in the West, so they have a little more liberty in sort of reinterpreting what Christianity means in the modern context.
Well, first things we should make sure to point out, because I think an issue here is the actual number of Christians in Japan. And according to Wikipedia, which, as we know, is an infallible source of information, infallible source of information.
Like the Pope.
Exactly, just like the Pope. speaking of Christianity, right? The Christians in Japan represent anywhere from 1% to 2% of the population. And in absolute numbers, works out to maybe up to 3 million Japanese Christians. So 1% to 2% of the population is pretty small. I mean, if you think about percentages of religions in the United States, you know, certainly a predominantly Christian nation, but Muslims, certainly way more Muslims in the United States than Christians in Japan. Without putting a number out, I'm going to look it up here, but I wouldn't be surprised if there were more Mormons in the United States than there were Christians in Japan. I'm going to look that up and confirm, but you're talking.
Well, later in that same Wikipedia article, it talks about how Christmas in Japan is celebrated more so as a secular holiday, much like in the United States with lights. And I know my brother actually lives in China, in Shanghai, and it's become much of the same there, where just because of an excess of availability of lights and so much of it being in the commercial products and media of the West, that Christmas could or Christianity could become a novel thing in Japan. So maybe not taken so seriously because it's not so new, but it's very light there. Christianity light. So they're going to try and take more symbolism from it and put it into other places, I guess.
Let me come back in with the statistics that I was referring to earlier. According to Wikipedia, again, perfectly infallible source of information, 1.7% of the United States is Mormons. To give you a sense, Judaism, percent of Jews in the United percent of the United States that are classified as Jews, 1.2% to 2.2%, some sort of estimate. Actually, the percentage that identifies as Muslims is actually smaller than that. It's 0.6% to 1.6%. So give you a little bit of relativism there.
So the number of Muslims in the United States is comparable to the number of Christians in Japan on a proportional basis.
If anything, actually, it's a smaller portion.
Smaller proportion. Okay. But it gives you a sense for the scope, right, where if somebody were to, say, make a movie about, like, a major Muslim historical area, like a region, and were to, say, make none of the people there Muslims and sort of play really fast and loose with, like, the dress and the traditions and the ethnicities. Like say if you made a movie about Persia, right, and they made them, like, sort of time travelers, and, like, you put Jake Gyllenhaal in it, it doesn't look Persian at all. And you sort of, like, messed around with some of the stories and stuff, like, and you didn't really care that much. It wouldn't necessarily be just because Islam is new in the United States. It might also have something to do with the fact that there just aren't enough Muslims in the United States to really draw much of a stink, I guess. Is that, or, I don't know. There's the other question, which is, like, well, go ahead.
Well, I'm just saying that I would really like to see a movie called Imam, in which the Imam hunts vampires. And keeps, faithful to the laws of Islam. I think that'd be pretty great.
That would be pretty spectacular. But I'll raise this. What do you think is the motive force behind society holding something secret? Because I think that there is a sense, even if you don't necessarily believe in a particular religion, where you might be scared to say bad things about it because there's a sort of oppressing moral sense, not moral sense, but oppressing sort of like normative sense that you ought not to because you're going to get yourself in trouble or because people won't be able to handle it. Right? Like, what is that? Do you think that that is something that works independently of the sort of political blocks to an extent? Is there sort of a cultural engine there? Where do you think that comes from? Like, why are things secret? Why do people not mess with people?
Because people get angry. But really angry, and on a big level and on a very small level. Like, if you from protesting outside of an abortion clinic or protesting outside of a church to making some kind of a joke at work that someone in the break room finds offensive and reports it to your boss, like, just from that, it just maybe that's not so much the origin, but how it's still taken care of, how it's still in place.
Pete, your question is a couple questions, isn't it? Like, are you asking what is the origin of the idea of the sacrosanct, or, you know, how do we come to regard things as sacrosanct, or is your question like, why in this modern enlightened day and age do we still deign to regard certain things as sacred, even though science has told us that in fact we are not made of angel dust, we're made of atoms and molecules?
Oh, neither. I'm not talking about, like, the religious idea of the sacred. I'm talking about the sort of cultural relationship of people with sacred topics. So, like, for example, I might be in a particular group of people, and in that group of people, I can't talk bad things about Firefly because Firefly is sacred. Right? I mean, I've started watching Firefly, and it's quite good, and I've been enjoying it, but I know that there's some people who are really, really into it, and I've been around those people. I would be careful about what I said, because it's a sensitive subject, and there's a social force behind it that makes me know, even though it's not an idea I necessarily share, that there's something I ought not to say. And what I'm saying is that the thing in Japan that matters the most with regards to the use of Christian symbols in manga and other assorted art is not, like, how many Christians there are, or, like, whether they're going to cause a big stink necessarily, because people cause big stinks all the time and nobody cares. It's like, what would it take? What is the origin of that force that gets people who don't agree with them to not say things that might potentially offend them or that they think are important to somebody else? It doesn't necessarily have to do with religion. like say things can be sacred and not be religious or super supernatural at all. In certain places, the theory of evolution is sacred because people are sick and tired of arguing about it, right? And so, like, they don't want to discuss it, and they get pissed off if you talk about it. I feel like I wanted to find sacred as closer to something that, like, is true, not even true, but it's just, like, something that is off-limits for criticism to an extent because it is valued highly or it is believed to be, like, beyond reproach, I'll say that much.
Well, let me give this other example here of something similar. I think in most workplaces that we probably belong to, bringing up things in conversation which are conservative and aligned with the Republican Party is in violation of what one would consider sacred, I'm probably getting myself in hot water here, but sacred leftist liberal progressive ideals, which are often espoused by most coworkers in the office. And what you're getting at there is that much like religion, that sort of
you work in New York, though, you know.
Right. So I'm saying in this environment, right? If this were in, say, Birmingham, Alabama, which I'm familiar with and grew up in, this would be reversed, right? But in New York, in my office in New York, where the progressive and the liberal is sacred, right? We much like as a religion, and again, I'm getting myself in the hot water here, I'm sure, but I'm going to keep going with it. Much like as that. You take it in. That's a very much an important part of your identity. It's very intrinsic. It gives value to the things that you do. And when those things are violated and trod upon, right, then that is a source of conflict. People understand that. They just want to avoid conflict. I think that's really what this is about here, is it not?
Right. That's what I was thinking. That it's right. That it's kind of self-preservative. If I agree to sort of observe your sacred cows, an expression which I suppose is offensive to certain religions I'm doing it out of a sense of self-preservation, right? I'm doing it in order to keep myself from having to deal with the poop storm when you take me to task for, you know, failing to observe them. I mean, I think it has to do with what we imagine is sacred. I mean, things that are sacred have to do, the anthropological roots of the sacred are probably things having to do with what? With survival or with group membership, right?
Right.
And when you threaten my survival or when you threaten my comrades, you know, or my community members, right? That's the kind of thing that ultimately you got to get up in arms about if you're going to continue to live in a cold and different world, way pre-modern, humanity. I think it's gotten kind of baroque because the kinds of groups that we imagine ourselves to be part of, like Firefly fans, are things that are inconsequential as regards survival anymore. But I
disagree. As a Firefly fan, I cannot imagine life without it.
Take my love, take my land. Hey, I love Firefly too. You know, don't get me wrong. I don't mean to offend any of the Firefly fans. I have a great deal of respect for you and your television show, and I enjoy it. I enjoy it as well.
See, and you're defending that, and you're saying that because of your social survival. You don't want to get kicked out of all of the cool clubs from all of the Serenity and Firefly fans.
Right, absolutely.
Which do you think there are more of in the United States? People who like Firefly or Muslims?
I think if there were more people who like Firefly, I think that show might still be on the air.
I would actually like to see a pie chart with those figures.
All I know is that I drew a comic of Josh Whedon, and I got in a lot of trouble for that one.
All right, let's move on. One last voicemail. This one about accents.
Hello, Overthinking It team. This is the so-called Timothy J. Swan calling in from latitude 51 degrees, 45 minutes and 3 seconds north. 1 degree, 15 minutes and 14 seconds west. That's the University of Oxford, one of the Overthinking It capitals of the world. I haven't been listening to the podcast recently because I have been catching up with old episodes. I've got about as far as episode 65, but one thing I simply had to ask you while the iron was roughly hot was about accents. With Robin Hood's coming out recently and a lot of discussion about Russell Crowe's supposedly English accent in the film, it's caused a lot of controversy over here in Great Britain. Don't know if you've heard about that over on the other side of the Atlantic. Flash forward, coming to an end, which features as it stars two British actors doing what seem to me convincing American accents, but may not seem convincing on the other side, and my own sad loss of a regional accent. What I'd love the panel to overthink is whether our voices are important to our identity. Does it matter if we sound like where we're from, if we sound like our class? Is it important that Russell Crowe sounds British when playing Robin Hood? Thank you and goodbye.
This may be a bigger topic in Britain than America, where, no, actually, I'm going to take back my point. Even as it comes back, comes out of my mouth, I'm going to pull it back in. I guess there is kind of a bigger tradition of class distinction through speech in Britain than there is in America. But I suppose you could talk in a certain way in America where people would make assumptions about your class and education background. I would say though that those assumptions are part and parcel of your regional background. That an accent. If I were to come on the podcast and be talking like this all the time, you'd make certain assumptions about my geographic origin, and from that, I think make assumptions about my class and education background.
I just assume you're a nice person.
Well, there are. I mean, we shouldn't lump the South together, right? Because there are Southern accents and Southern accents, and actually,
a little twang.
Absolutely. Like Texas sounds very different from Georgia, there are class distinctions in Southern accents and racial distinctions in accents of the American South. So it's a big, maybe the American South is more like, more like the British Isles. But I just have a stronger connection to the idea of, a received pronunciation, of British English versus, sort of working class London or what got called a Cockney accent, for a long time. And, I don't know, Liverpool and, Southern England and, all these things, like that this was a bigger marker of class, and that one of the ways in which you could sort of advance socially was to eliminate the regionalisms from your accent and take on the received pronunciation, the RP, which is the accent of Oxford and Cambridge, as we hear Mr. Swan bemoaning the loss of his own regionalisms in his speech. Is it important?
Hey, Matt, I have a quick question.
Yeah.
Where does the rain in Spain fall?
In my pants.
In your pants. Oh, I don't know if that's how it goes, but. I interrupted.
Do you think that story? Do you think the Shaw Pygmalion story and the musical My Fair Lady would play as an American story?
Oh, I have this one anecdote to hear. Let me posit this one here. Is one of my coworkers still retains a strong Brooklyn accent? As in, I saw it. Right. Now he likes a good cup of coffee. He talks like that. His father was denied admission to, I think, Cooper Union in New York City. And at least the way that he tells it was because of his strong Brooklyn accent. Too much of an accent can get into their college. I'm probably butchering it right there a little bit too, but you get the idea.
Well, I come from California, where we don't really have any sort of regionalisms in our speech at all, and we speak, standard American English. I don't know what you guys are talking about. I think you're all very intolerant, and you need to chill out.
Matt, this is getting ridiculous. I think you really need to shake your trap. I'm going to go over to Pete's house. We're going to crack open a couple of PBRs. We're going to watch, and we're going to watch our neighbors throw washing machines off the Tobin Bridge. Right?
That was
what we're going to do. It will be a good test.
I stomped you, Natalie. What were you going to say before I jumped in there?
Well, I don't know if you gentlemen have watched America's Next Top Model ever. One of the first things that I thought of, I have no idea what season or in what particular episode this was, but each of the models or the amateur models have to be in a commercial. And Tyra Banks makes it very clear that the women on the show have to drop their accents. And there are some girls from, or some women from some very poor backgrounds who do not speak very clearly, like a real Clearasil model would. And she basically has to punch it out of them and tell them they can't be a top model if they don't enunciate their words and they don't drop their regional accent.
That's funny, isn't it? Because you think of it, you associate models with like photographs and, you know, and the non-speaking roles in the Clearasil commercials, like the, you know, the crystalline droplets of water splashing and, you know, splashing out from the face as they, in a most fetching and becoming way, you know, rinse the cleanser off of their skin, which had no need to be cleansed in the first place. Not with the talkie, which generally falls to actors nowadays, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the line between models and actors is very thin at this point, I think, right? Like, so many actors just stand there and so many models talk. And you know, they all want to direct. So,
and only LeVar Burton and Jonathan Frakes can actually direct. Yeah. So there you go.
Yeah, I mean, I actually applied for a job as a scout once. This was when I was desperate for work, and I applied for a job with an agency to try to become a talent scout. And I figured because I had training in theater and experience with the arts, that I could be a theater scout and I could go around. But really what they wanted, when they said they wanted scouts for actors, is it's the same thing as being a scout for a model. It just means going around and looking for pretty people. And you assume that they can act after you find out that they're pretty. So I think in the business, there's definitely, I mean, it's not everybody, it's not everything, but it's definitely like a strong imperative that like, when look, you might be looking for qualitatively different things, but you're looking for sort of the same general gist when you're looking for actors and for models. It's different skills, but those can be taught. Pretty can't be taught. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe I haven't watched enough Next Top Model to know the finer points of modeling. I'm sure Natalie could rock the catwalk in ways that I would not be able to imitate without everyone laughing at me, which I guess would be a notable good way of reason to go about trying. But anyway.
Pete, I wouldn't be too sure about that, actually. To bring it back to another part of Mr. Swan's question or his remarks, I think this might be a good segue, at least, but particularly growing up outside of Boston, 15 miles outside of the city, I have no Boston accent, except for sometimes I say bedroom instead of bedroom. But the way that accents are portrayed in TV, whether it matters or in films, does it need to be perfect? Does it need to be spot on? And the thing that immediately popped to my brain was Julianne Moore on 30 Rock and her
right.
awful Boston accent. And the thing that about it that I think was the problem was that her character was from Waltham. Am I getting this correct?
Mm-hmm.
Can anyone confirm? Yeah, well, and Waltham, like someone from the town I am from, would not have a crazy, very thick Boston accent. So it's not that it was bad. It was that no one from that town would speak like that or would speak with a thick Boston accent.
Well, so you're actually getting at the heart of the question, Natalie, which is, you know, I mean, or at least the impetus for the question, which is, you know, is it bad if Russell Crowe is doing a bad English accent? Well, you know, and so what is the responsibility of actors generally and sort of people who produce entertainment to make sure that the actors do the accents right? Now, with respect to Robin Hood specifically, I'll say that this, you know, he when did Robin Hood operate? Like 12th or 13th century, right? Or at least the legends date from at least that far back, yeah?
Is Rather going to speak in middle English?
Well, my point is that the English that was being spoken, Juan that Robin Hood with his surest suta,
Please do the rest of the podcast like that, Matt. We won't be able to understand you, but it'll be awesome.
That the English that was spoken bears very little relation to the English that we speak now. It was a hybrid of German and French, and hadn't even standardized into the English of Chaucer and Langland at that point. And actually, the
I forget about King Arthur. King Arthur was like Celtic practically.
Yeah, back in the
so he
I
wasn't
mean,
even speaking anything. Yeah,
that was even back in the day. I suppose I should consult the ultimate authority, the infallible Wikipedia, which is sacred which is sacred to us on this podcast. I suppose I should consult that in determining the time that Robin Hood is supposed to be taken care of. But here's
it's not hard.
Here's,
it's associated with the Third Crusade. You know, the Third Crusade, that's the 1300s.
Yeah, so there you
go. Because, I believe. I mean, I'm off by a few years, but I think so.
So here's the thing, and I mean, this goes along with Nazis having British accents or Romans having British accents in Hollywood movies. You're creating a system of signification when you decide what accents are going to be in a dramatic work, and the important thing is that it have sort of internal coherence and that it have meanings that are intelligible to the audience for whom it's intended, which is I think why British accents work for Nazis in Hollywood movies, right? Because this is the British voice, American voice dichotomy, is kind of shoehorned into recapitulating the dichotomy between the heroes of the movies and their Nazi antagonists. So,
like the rebels in the Alliance and the Imperial officers in Star Wars, where
sure.
The Imperial officers speak with British accents and the rebels speak with American accents.
Right. And there's, certain kinds of, you get certain kinds of nationalism, and I'm sure it's offensive to someone somewhere. I'm sure any distinction like this is offensive to someone somewhere, but the point is at a certain point you have to have a movie, and so you make distinctions that sort of work for the knots. So if Russell Crowe is meant to be doing a contemporary British accent and he doesn't do it well, I would say that that's just bad acting, and there's not a ton to overthink there. There's a question sometimes about how sociologically perfect dialect work has to be in theater, film, and television, but for something like Robin Hood, where, if you're not speaking French, you're probably not doing Robin Hood right. So you just kind of go with what works for the nonce, right?
Yeah.
Matt, on that last point, you bring up an interesting point about if you're not doing French, and what we're talking about, if you're not doing Middle English, you're not doing it right. Let's not forget The Passion of the Christ, which went to great lengths, right, to have the dialogue entirely in Aramaic, Hebrew and Latin in an attempt to sort of get past, just how the Romans speak in British accents and have it be that, which I don't know quite exactly how that fits in here, but that's such an exception case that I don't know if it
well,
exactly
that's, I mean okay look we
accents.
we can talk about a continuum of being responsible to the sociology, right, to being responsible to the exact details of the historical period that you're depicting.
I think you guys are softballing this. I think you guys are really lobbing this one over the plate, and we can be a lot more direct about it. I think it's all about politics. I think that the whether or not Russell Crowe speaks in a British accent has to do with the identification of the British people, their self-identification, their stance as a cogent political group, and the hegemonic discourse that declares that the British people exist, that the English people exist, right? And like, if you have an accent, say you have an accent from a region, that accent drifts away and people don't know it, right? The accent's main purpose is to identify you as being part of that particular group. And if that accent drifts away, all that identifies the group also drifts away. I mean, I was in Philadelphia earlier this weekend. And one thing I always think about when I was in Philadelphia is they got that bell everywhere. It's just a bell with a crack in it, and it's everywhere. And it's this symbol and has this really important political purpose in defining what the city is and the authority and the discursive authority about what Philadelphia is and as an institution. And if you take away that bell, like, what have you got? Right? And then you think about, you know,
cheesesteak.
As American cities, what? You got cheesesteak. Yeah, I mean. And the thing is, for every city, you want to pick something that the city stands for. And I think that that's important for political reasons, for the power that's concentrated in the city. And cities that don't have something like that to focus on lose political influence. They end up, I think, losing money. I think they end up losing, like, authority. I think that, you know, this is reasons why people don't go to, like, where people make fun of Cleveland, right? Cleveland doesn't have anything, except for, like, Drew Carey, right? But then he's, by putting himself forward as a symbol of Cleveland, he empowers Cleveland. And I think that when you're trying to say change the, put it in Aramaic and in Latin in the Passion of the Christ, you're making the authoritative group the classical text, which is analogous to this sort of idea that, that religious authority doesn't come from contemporary discourse. It comes from these original texts and that whole sort of fiction.
Which is ironic.
We derive our authority from the, yeah.
It's ironic, specifically in the case of the Passion of the Christ, because of the wide variety and the questionable authority of some of the source texts that Mel Gibson was willing to use, as source materials for that film, right?
It's also ironic because he's making a new movie, right? And he's not reading the Bible to people, right? He's like making a new movie about it, and he's using sources, but it's still a new work in the same way that Ben-Hur was a new work when it was made,
right? This
is just because it uses the original language. I don't know.
Works of dramatic art are ipso facto interpretive, right? They have to take some stance on the source material or on the material that's being presented. And a lot of the work, a lot of sort of behind the scenes work, whether people know it or not, goes into making works of art seem not interpretive but purely representative, right? And that. That,
which is just a way of hiding the strings. It's just hiding the strings because they're still doing the same thing.
Right, and that, I mean...
There's not anything intrinsically wrong with hiding the strings, though, right? As long as you don't think that, wait a minute, I see the strings.
Well, it's a question of what you feel, you know, what you feel art is and what you feel responsible to. I mean, I suppose I am invoking a kind of hegemonic discourse when I say that all works of dramatic art are necessarily interpretive, and that those people who think that they can be representative are merely fooling themselves and are trying to fool us, whether intentionally or unconsciously. I suppose that this is, right. I'm making a kind of absolutist statement about relativism by doing that. But
sure. Then the drag of the snake eats its own tail, and we get in trouble. But
it's turtles all the way down. But but I think I'm right about this. So I have no trouble asserting it. But there's, you know, people, and I guess when I talk about a continuum of sociological responsibility, people feel allegiance to different things when they do accents or when they recreate with accuracy the kind of the details of a particular time and place. Right now, saying that that's in service of a larger political aim, saying that that's kind of always in service of a larger political aim, I think that's probably true. The point that Pete's making, and look, we've managed to tie together accents, the sacred, and somehow Star Trek as well.
Well, I will tell you this, because if there's one man who knows how to enunciate, it's Captain Sisko. And if you, when you found out babies weren't delivered by storks, that was an epiphany. So Sisko has his own accent. Sisko declares authority on Deep Space Nine by developing an entirely new accent that exists nowhere else in the galaxy, and speaking its people, becoming a nation of one that not even his own son belongs to, because his son speaks nothing like him, because apparently his son was not a member of a Shakespeare company, but his starship captain and space station captain was a member of
it. Hey, you guys, can we one day have a podcast devoted entirely to taking this hegemonic discourse to its uttermost extreme and find the most mundane things and talk about how they're part of the hegemonic discourse?
You know,
sure.
Mark,
do you want to do all breakfast cereals, or do you want to do things other than breakfast cereals?
Yeah, let's, I mean,
you'll never get me Lucky Charms.
Let's, yeah, no, I mean, if I can invoke the authority of Cap'n Crunch, you know, or the, you know, aristocratic privilege of Count Chocula.
Yeah. I prefer to rely on the original sources. That is, Fred Flintstone, his Fruity and Cocoa Pebbles. They have history on their side.
Well, if this podcast is if this podcast stands for one thing, it's ending at about an hour. to try to leave you wanting more, whether or not we've failed at that. Entirely. I feel bad because we just did. I was like, how are we going to stretch this listener feedback out? We only have three voicemails and three emails, and we didn't get to the emails at all. We have an email from Lucas. We have an email from Aiden, and I have an email from Sam. Maybe we'll have to do another episode and be part of the listener feedback experience on the Overthinking It podcast. You can email us at podcast@overthinkingit.com, or you can call the podcast voicemail, where we got those excellent voicemails today, 203-285-6401. That's 203-285-6401. We'll be back next week with an all-new episode, as we have done every week for more than 2 years now, or coming up on 2 years. Actually, you know what? The 2 year anniversary of the weekly podcast, I think, is maybe a couple months away. But, you know, but the next one, I guess, is going to be.
We snuck in some extras here and there, yeah.
We snuck in some extras, but all, I mean, of the regularly numbered episodes, it wasn't until, I think, the low teens that we were actually squeezing them out weekly. So,
okay.
So, you know, I want to commemorate that 2 year mark, because in a way that's even more than the absolute number of the podcast. The fact that we've actually produced it weekly in that time, we will continue to produce it weekly. But if you can't get enough overthinking, you know what to do. You visit us on the web at www.overthinkingit.com, the site that subjects the popular culture to a level of scrutiny It probably doesn't deserve. It probably doesn't deserve. That was, I don't even know what that was.
It don't deserve it.
It probably don't deserve none. It probably
was that Klingon?
That was my fake Klingon accent. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that was lower class Klingon.